Today is the 15th of July 2015, and I'm here with Mary Evans recording an LSE oral history interview for the 120th anniversary of LSE. Mary, please can you tell me your date of birth and your full name?
I was born in 1946, and my full name is Mary Sonia Evans.
So please can you tell me when you first came to LSE?
I first came to LSE in the autumn of 1964.
And what did you come to LSE to do?
I came to LSE to read politics. I think actually in those days it was called government, and it was part of the BSc Econ, which was in those days a University of London degree.
And did you come here as an undergraduate?
Yes, I did.
What was your first impression of campus?
I was completely overwhelmed, overawed, and thought I would never make any sense of this place, and help, what had I gone and done?
Did you study with lots of other students from around the world?
No, I think actually in those days, the LSE, certainly as far as an undergraduate was concerned, the student body was pretty much from the UK. There weren't anything like as many postgraduate students as there are now. I mean, I think that the student body at the LSE has changed absolutely dramatically in the last 40, 50 years. But when I came, most of the students in my year were from this country.
Did you know you wanted to work in academia at that time?
It's a terrible thing to say, but in those days we had to fill in everybody still does, an application form for university. And on that form there were two things which have now disappeared. They asked you what your father's occupation was, and they asked you what you wanted to do in the future when you'd graduated. And I put down, be an academic. And I cannot now believe that at 17 I actually wrote that on a form. I really am constantly amazed by it. I mean, it's a memory which really surprises me, but I did, and that's what I wrote in that piece, on that piece of paper.
So how did you first become interested in the area of gender?
It took a long time. Certainly in 1964 it wasn't anywhere on the syllabus, so it wasn't there when I first came to LSE. I suppose I first became interested in it, like a lot of people of my generation, from the women's movement of the late 60s and the early 70s. And then in 1976, I spent a year at Harvard, and I there encountered quite a lot of work about what was in those days called women's studies. It wasn't actually called gender in the 70s. And I got particularly interested through the academic work, because I already had the political interests in it, and I'd already read quite a lot of feminist literature. But I did, from that point onwards, from actually seeing these other courses going on in the States and from seeing what people were doing, I got more interested in the idea of putting these ideas onto the academic syllabus.
Did you return to LSE with that in mind?
I wasn't at LSE in 1976. I had a job already. I was teaching sociology at the University of Kent at Canterbury. And I had a year off, I think I had a year up. Anyway, whatever. And when I went back, I thought, OK, this is what I now want to do.
So when did you return to LSE?
I returned to LSE. OK, I did my first degree at LSE. I did a master's at LSE. Then I went to the University of Sussex. Then I got a job at the University of Kent. I came back to the LSE, actually, at the other bookend of my life, as it were. So I came at the beginning of my academic career to the LSE, and I also came at the end of my academic career to the LSE. That's what I mean by bookends. Because when I retired from the University of Kent, which was in 1926, I applied to the Gender Institute at the LSE to come here as a visiting fellow, because I wanted to go on doing academic work. And the Gender Institute, of course, was the place which would have made and did make and does make the most sense of those interests. So I duly wrote to the LSE and said, please can I come? They said yes. And a couple of years later, I became a centennial professor. So that's the story. So it is very much a career framed by a beginning and an end at the LSE.
Did you find that teaching at LSE differed very much from studying at LSE?
No, actually, except... I mean, what has changed enormously are, well, a number of things. The physical plant of the place has changed out of all recognition. Secondly, I also, when I taught here, when I taught postgraduates, I was teaching students who came, I think, more or less entirely from the UK. I think in a group, say, of 15, there was one person from the UK. Last year I taught undergraduates and the group was entirely from the UK. So in that sense, of course, at least as far as the undergraduates are concerned, it corresponds to my experience that the undergraduate body of this institution is still very much drawn from this country.
Do you find that's particular in gender studies?
No, I think that's probably pretty much the same across the school.
And does your understanding and career in gender studies, do you think it gives you a unique perspective of LSE itself?
I should say before I answer more of that question that in a sense I'm not a, well not in a sense, but I am not a full-time academic at LSE. So I don't have the kind of contact with... committees with various other kinds of administration that lots of my colleagues here do, which is kind of just the ordinary job of being a full-time academic, because that's what I've done, but it's not what I do here. So in terms of those experiences, I think what you would notice, and certainly in terms of what I notice, is the, I suppose, the gendered hierarchy of power at the LSE. But I would also say, and I think it's really important to say it, that I do not think that this is any kind of special particularity of the LSE. I think it's a general characteristic of most UK universities. And certainly, I think that this has remained pretty consistent over the 40-odd years that I've spent in UK universities. It's changed a bit in that there are more women in more academic jobs, but the hierarchy, I think, has remained pretty consistently male. So that's what I notice. But what you notice, I suppose, so what I'm saying, I suppose, is I notice the continuity of that kind of structure of the administration.
Did you find that when you first arrived here as a student, did you find that there was an imbalance in the amount of male and female students then?
Totally. I mean, I think we were 10% of the student body or something when I first came here. That is actually the thing which I think is... anybody, again, of my generation would say, and it's across the UK, that when I went to university anyway, 6% of my age cohort went to university. So higher education really was something which was a pretty... it was not in any way a general experience. In 2015, it is a much more general experience. The other thing was that far fewer women went to university in those days than did men. So when I first arrived at LSE, you know, the few female students that were here, we kind of were in a minority, I have to say. And I remember being taught by... I think throughout my career at LSE, now this is really interesting, and I'm not sure how much this has changed. I was taught by one woman, and she was teaching as a part-time teacher in the first year. And I think that that's a pattern which might persist in quite a lot of universities, in that the democratisation of higher education, as it's called, has been made possible in the main through using a lot of part-time casual staff, as they're called, and many of those people are women. And so that's a really, I suppose, over 40, 50 years, whatever it is, it's quite extraordinary that that experience, which I had in 1964, might be exactly the same for somebody in 2015.
What would you say were your highlights of being here as a student?
The sheer constant endless interest is, there isn't one highlight, it's one great big long highlight in a sense. By the sort of February of my first year, I had sort of recovered the shock of getting here, recovered from the shock of getting here, and I'd found my way around and I had, you know, realised what I was doing. And after that, I just found more or less every day, every week, fascinating. I mean, I'm an enthusiast. I just loved it. I mean, it was just so interesting. And the reason that it was so interesting was not just the teaching, some of which was sheer magic and which I still remember as sheer magic. Other was less magical, it has to be said. But even that... that was interesting because of the contrast to the absolutely extraordinary teaching. But the fellow students, I learned so much from my fellow students, and there was so much humour and there was so much irreverence, and it was just a world which I found full of interest.
Were you involved in any student clubs or something?
I was General Secretary of the Students' Union for 1 year when I was at the LSE. I cannot remember which year it was, but I suspect it was probably my second year, because in those days we didn't have second year exams. So if you were going to spend your time doing something other than working very hard, the second year was the year to do it. But when I first came to the LSE, the address to the new students was given by the then director, a man called Sir Sidney Kane, and he said to us, I think if any of you are doing more than 6 hours a day academic work, then you ought to ask yourself some very serious questions. I mean, he said something along those lines. So he was virtually saying to us, I mean, it was like giving us permission to not just work, but to take part in all kinds of other events and activities, do all kinds of other things, sit and talk to each other, which in fact is what, for a lot of the time, we did.
Did you find that being secretary of the student union was a position where there was a lot of political debate, a lot of political discussion?
There was a huge amount of political debate. It's not, some of it was to do with the Students' Union, but some of it was to do with other political, other kinds of student union societies. So, yes, some of it was part of the Students' Union, but other parts of it were just initiated by all kinds of other organisations around the place. But there was some great debates, and there were some great figures who came to the LSE to speak.
Did you have a particular favourite place on campus?
Particular
favourite place on campus?
I had a particular seat in the old library, which is a very old library, and it was in those days in the old building, which I think it was on the first floor of the library. So I liked that bit of the library because it was relatively open and accessible. I also liked what was in those days the third floor coffee bar in the old building. I don't know what it is now. I think it's become academic offices. It was completely unsmart. It's nothing like anything looks around here today. So those were the two places, I think, where I spent most of my time. I mean, it's very difficult now probably for students to realise how small the LSE was 40 years ago. I mean, it really was the old building, the East Building, the building that is now being demolished, and the St Clement's Building. And I don't remember other bits to the LSE. I mean, the two pubs were here, and there might have been other odd buildings about the place, but that was actually the LSE campus, and the library was entirely in the old building.
So you've seen the new library now?
I have indeed seen the new library now, yes.
Do you ever go there to work?
I don't go there to work, but I go there to browse. I've been doing some work in the Women's Library, which is wonderful and actually is a brilliant place to go and work in. And it's just completely different from my day.
How so?
I suppose, well, to start with, it's packed. To start with, in term time, it is clearly packed to the roof, and it looks to me as if, you know, there is not a spare seat the times I've been in there in term time. But what has also changed is, of course, the technology has changed, because in those days, there was no such thing, for example, as an online journal. If you were going to work, you had to go to a library to find the resources. There was no chance of sitting at home and, you know, looking something up on your laptop. So what's changed is that whole physical structure of learning. I mean, if we wanted to look at a journal article, we had to go and look in these dusty old tomes on a shelf somewhere. And so libraries has a different kind of purpose, I suppose, in that we were completely dependent upon their resources. I mean, those resources did not exist anywhere else. So they were vital places. I'm sure they are to students today, but it's not quite the same, I think, given that so much is now accessible online.
How do you feel about the way the Gender Institute has grown, the LSE, over the years?
Delighted, very pleased, a very welcome growth. It's wonderful that it has been so consistently supported by students, by lots of other staff in the LSE. I mean, it isn't, obviously there are people who specifically work here, but there are a lot of other people who have played their part in supporting it. So I think it's been a great addition to the LSE. Nothing but praise, 110%.
And what do you think the future of the department is?
A difficult question. I think probably expansion, perhaps, in terms of specialist interests. For example, the new centre about gender, war and violence has very close links with and roots in the Gender Institute. So I think probably one way in which the future, one possibility about the Gender Institute's future is that in the same way it might give rise to other sorts of specialist centres which have particular relationships to questions of gender. So I think that's one way. And I think a second way is perhaps thinking about expanding undergraduate teaching on gender, which at the moment is both quite limited but also quite general, by which I mean there is, if you looked in the undergraduate handbook, you would find very little that is specifically on gender. But on the other hand, most courses these days discuss gender differences. It's more or less become an acknowledged part of most disciplinary curriculum. So it's there, but it's there in a different way.
What do you think your main highlights as a faculty member have been here? What are the things that you really stick out in your memory for you?
I think some of the one thing that was a really great day was the 20th anniversary of the Gender Institute. There was a special day and it was a huge success. It was really quite remarkable in the number of people who came, the interest that the speakers generated. So I would say that was a tremendous tribute to the Gender Institute and all the people that work here. And it really does stand out in my memory. Otherwise, it's a very much more day-to-day memory, I suppose, which is, you know, coming to work and always having a sense that there are colleagues to talk to about work, to hear about what is going to happen to next. So there is an ordinary day-to-day feeling about the Gender Institute, which I think is a very positive one for everybody who works here.
In your career as an academic, do you find, have you found that there's been cultural differences between one institution and another? So for instance, institutions in the US or other institutions in the UK compared to LSE?
Yes, huge. I mean, not huge ones, because there are most UK universities, well, English universities, not so much the Scottish universities. English universities work within a very common sort of funding pattern, and et cetera, and all those kinds of similar institutional concerns. It's really difficult to name some of the differences, but those differences do exist. My own view is that the pre-92 universities are pretty homogeneous. There's not, despite all the university tables and the REF and all these kinds of things which actually divide places and, you know, create competition, there's actually not all that much difference between most of the pre-92 universities. But the sharp divide, in my experience, is between the pre-92 and the post-92 universities, because the post-92 universities had to play, still have to play, I think, a really huge game of catch-up, because they simply don't have and didn't have the same kind of resources that the pre-92 universities had. So you do notice when you go there that some kinds of facilities, for example, libraries and staff accommodation, are much more limited than they would be in pre-92 universities. But on the other hand, it does not mean to say that post-92 universities aren't doing some things which are really extraordinarily innovative and interesting. I mean, I'm interested in detective fiction, and for the last 2 years I've been to a conference on detective fiction organised by Bath Spa University, and it has attracted for 2 years running about 70 people to a 3-day residential conference, and it's fantastically interesting. People come from all over the world, and there it is, it's being done, it's being run, it's making a difference to people who are interested in that kind of in that particular subject. So it isn't so much that there aren't wonderful things being done, but what you do notice is the way in which funding patterns, history, have created differences between these universities, and those differences still exist.
When you first attended LSE, I assume that the education was less expensive.
It was free.
It was free. Okay. So how does that compare to now?
You don't come out with debt. I mean, you might come out with a bit of debt. Compared with the sort of £60,000, which is the current estimate, or the rough current estimate, you know, you may be owed owed the bank £100 when you graduated. I mean, it's just a completely different situation. So we didn't pay fees, and most of the people I knew who were at LSE, and in fact, most people got some sort of grant. Anybody who was a student got a nominal £50 a year, regardless of their parents' income. And then how much else you got after that was actually related to how much your parents earned. So it was means tested, but people got grants.
Did you find it expensive living in central London?
Incredibly expensive, but what was the difference between London and the rest of the country, which is probably still the case, was rent. Not so much in those days travel or food, because a lot of people ate in Hall in the evening or ate in LSE in wherever the refectory was. And London was not, in fact, no cities in the country were full of places to eat. So in a way, there was less to spend money on. And that might sound curious because there are always things to spend money on. But our expectations, perhaps, were not so high. We did not expect, we did not know about all kinds of special food, gourmet food, all the kinds of... The food culture, I think, is probably sort of late 70s, early 80s. And it was only really emerging in the late 60s.
So what was the food in the refectory?
Ghastly. Ghastly. It was truly horrible. There was a particular meat pie that a lot of some of my people I knew used to eat, which still makes me feel ill when I think about it. Because it did come in a kind of, they were individual and they were cut into them, and this awful brown goo would come oozing out of this meat pie, and which was, of course, routinely served with chips. It was disgusting, I have to say.
A lot of other people said that.
But the place that was still here, which really, really surprises me, is that little cafe by, what's it called, by the entrance to the old building.
Wright's Bar
was there. And Wright's Bar used to sell, I mean, I'm sure they still do, they seem to sell bucket loads of chips, and they've clearly got rich on chips.
The prices are still pretty cheap.
Oh, they're cheap, yeah, yeah.
What was graduating like? Do you remember what it was like to graduate?
We were all very pleased. We were, but we didn't do graduation, actually. And again, I think that's something that has come in everywhere as a ceremony, and has changed. LSE in those days, like other London colleges, didn't give its own degrees. So in order to take part in the ceremony, you had to go for what was called the Royal Nod from the Queen Mother in the Albert Hall. And I didn't go, and I don't know anybody else who went. So we just got our degrees through the post. So, but it was very, I mean, obviously we were delighted to get them. And
are you required to attend graduation ceremonies for students now?
I'm not, but I think probably there's some kind of, I'm quite sure all departments expect some people to turn up for graduation. I mean, it is, I think it's part of the job. I don't think that that's the problem.
Your most memorable teachers when you were a student?
Michael Oakeshott, Ralph Miliband. Those two particularly, and Megan Desai, who gave the first year economics lectures, of which I didn't understand a word, but they were clearly very impressive lectures. Michael Oakeshott's second year lectures on political philosophy or maybe politics were completely, that's what I said before, there were some lectures which were magical, and they were magical lectures. And you could have, you know, they were just outstanding lectures on the history of political philosophy. He gave 24 lectures in the on this subject, and about 20 of them were on the Greeks, and then of whom clearly, quite obviously, he thought a great deal. And there were remaining, I'm probably exaggerating, but the main point of interest for him was classical Greek philosophy, and they were just absolutely fascinating.
So do you also find it exhilarating and exciting working with your colleagues now, the faculty now?
I do, but in different ways. I mean, it's entirely a different way. I mean, I don't listen to them lecture, except if they occasionally give big public lectures. But that's not all that often because it's a very public event, and for anybody it's very demanding to do that. But what is interesting are the much more informal occasions, the reading groups and the seminars and these kinds of things. That is really, that is terrific. That makes a real difference.
Working here? Also while studying here.
Okay. While studying here, I think for me, coming from a provincial girls' school where I'd been taught a very narrow curriculum, you know, history was the Tudors, so I knew a great deal about the Elizabethan House of Commons, but I didn't know much about history outside England or after that. English literature, we were taught, stopped pretty much with Jane Austen. Stopped and started with Jane Austen, really. And when I first got here, there were lots of people talking about people I had never heard of, names I didn't know and couldn't pronounce. And so that was one of the challenges, actually. And a lot of people came from, they were either older, sort of in their early 20s, or they'd come. And I think this, to me, was a huge difference between the education of girls at that time and the education of boys, because my brother went to an all-boys school, and I knew boys at that school in their sixth form. They were doing what I suppose we would have called, or was called in the 60s, Plato to NATO, which was a first-year course which the University of Sussex used to teach. But it kind of gave people an overview, perhaps a very Western-centric view, but certainly a view of high Western culture. And we hadn't done anything like that. So if you knew anything outside it, and I was a very, very enthusiastic reader, it was entirely because you happened to have those interests. And the real challenge was actually catching up with that kind of general education, which, although in some ways I had been very well and thoroughly taught, the teaching really had no breadth in the sense of giving people a sense of the generality of high culture, the canon, if you like, from certainly Chaucer, which is, of course, where, well, certainly I think in those days many people's English syllabus started, but it certainly didn't go on into the 20th century. I mean, you know, it really did stop pretty much halfway through the 19th century. So it was that sense of, my goodness, there are people coming here who have heard and know about Descartes, they've heard of Hegel, they know about these things already. They don't know about them probably in any detail, they haven't probably been, you know, asked to read them, but they've acquired a kind of means of access into a kind of cultural map of the Western world. And that was the real challenge for me. And that's what I mean by the shock of the first term, because I suddenly encountered people whose teaching, not necessarily even their experience of life, they'd probably been to boys' grammar schools, a lot of them, but that experience of teaching and what it was thought appropriate, I suppose, for boys to know was just very different from mine. And that was, I think, the most demanding and surprising thing, that all of a sudden I was encountering this. And they knew, you see, they knew the chronology, if you like, of the Enlightenment. They knew the difference between, they knew where and which century Hobbes and Locke existed in. And I was still at the point of thinking, Hobbes? Locke? And But, of course, you could just then go to the library and read about this. I mean, it was pretty easy to sort of educate yourself in this. But I think I did, well, certainly I had to do it. And I think that was a real difference. And I don't, I think that actually, that in a different way, that is still quite important. And I'm absolutely certain, of course, that in places, Oxford and Cambridge are the obvious examples, but people who come from some schools just have a much greater access to that generality, that sense of owning, knowing, it being important for people to know about, that kind of width of, well, what is now, of course, would be expected to be a global culture. I mean, in my day, it was very much a European culture. But so that's the main difference, I think.
Did you face any resistance as a woman when you first came to LSE?
None whatsoever. Absolutely none whatsoever. I mean, I've found people incredibly, teachers and students, just incredibly supportive. And no, I really didn't. I thought it was a very friendly and supportive place.
Do you think that's unique to LSE, or do you think that could be found in higher education across the UK?
I think it's very patchy. I've got friends who went to Oxford at the same time as me, who went there from state grammar schools, who hated every minute of it, who really loathed it. I mean, I've got one very, very good friend who went from a boys' grammar school to Oxford. And it is a complete exaggeration, but he said he only went out of his room if he absolutely had to. Because he couldn't stand the sound of baying public school voices. I mean, he came, you know, in those days, you know, he got away with it. He went to tutorials, he got his first, he did very well. I mean, he became a very successful academic. But that class difference, I would think it probably still persists, although in different ways. But certainly, if I think in the 1960s, that was there, certainly for people going to Oxbridge. I don't think at the LSE, I don't think there was much sense of, I didn't cut, you know, maybe there were people who'd been to public schools, but you didn't get that sense of, oh my God, you know, there's sort of braying voices all around you.
What have been the challenges for you here now as a member of faculty at LSE?
Again, because of the particular nature of my attachment to LSE, the challenges, I think, are the challenges of, are really intellectual ones, of being in a place where people very much are on top of their subject, ahead of their subject, making their subject, indeed, and just being aware of what is changing and how quickly things are changing. I would put it down to that now.
What do you think lies ahead for LSE in the future?
I would hope it would preserve a great deal of what it already has, which is an interest in debate. I think that's absolutely fundamental. I think if the institution was to tie itself to a particular politics, a particular mission statement, it would be a disaster. And I see the place of the LSE as a place where it can maintain debate, dissent, difference, diversity, all those words. That's what I would hope for it will be and go on being in the future.
So in light of everything... In light of everything that we've talked about, is there anything you want to talk about that you feel like I haven't covered?
Let me think.
Or any memories that you want to share that you feel like I haven't asked you about?
No, not really. I suppose what I would say about it is that being an undergraduate student here really was a rewarding experience. I mean, I really enjoyed it. And I enjoyed it because of the freedom And in some ways as well, the kind of, it was highly coloured, if that makes sense. There was tremendous depth to the lectures and some of the personalities who were giving those lectures. And there was something which was a very long way away from sort of monochrome processing of students. So there were all kinds of things which I'm sure nowadays would make people faint, you know, very little demands for written work, very little supervision of students, all the kinds of things which, you know, tend to be now part of everyday life in universities. But it also gave people a huge amount of space, and I think it always allowed people space to not just pursue their own interests, because that's too vague, but actually to think about ways of, or different ways of actually thinking about what they were being taught. I suppose that's how I would put it. It's quite, it's perhaps a rather subtle difference, but I think it was very much about allowing people actually time, and certainly in some ways, and very importantly, the resources, but most specifically time to think about what they were doing and also think about what they wanted to make of it. So pressure, yes, to get a very good degree. Everybody wanted that. That hasn't changed an iota. But there was also a space to think about different ways of getting a good degree. I think there was a sense of academic freedom about it, and also that it was completely legitimate to challenge the people who were teaching you.